Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar for 2021, September 3. And I be John Pasmino. Our topic today is Jupiter in 2021. Make sure you have the accompanying video file with the slideshow. If not, go to www.nyskies.org. Among the punch words at the top of the home page is audio video files. Click it. On the AV files page describes how the video and audio file combine into the presentation. It also tells you about our email group where you can post the answer to our quiz and generally ask questions and comments about the session and, of course, engage with astronomy with the other members of the group. At the bottom are files for the current and many previous sessions. The ones for today, September 3rd, are titled Jupiter in 2021. All right. I assume that you have the video file and you spotted it on slide 1. And this is the title slide, somewhat summarizes the AV files page. At the bottom are links to many supplemental articles which should help you appreciate Jupiter and, in general, planetary motions. The file jup.nep.htm shows a triple conjunction of Jupiter and Neptune. It occurs during Jupiter's retrograde loop and it illustrates the way Jupiter and actually all the outer planets wander around in the sky using Neptune, which pretty much stands still, as a marker. SL9.JUP is the account of my, with a group of other astronomers, experience seeing the collision of comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 against the disk of Jupiter. 1956-2015 referred to years 1956-2015 and shows how you can use the movements of Jupiter, also Saturn, as waypoints in your life. The difference between those 2 years is 60 years, which amounts to 2 revolutions of Saturn around the Sun, or 5 of Jupiter, and how I, in 2015, saw them line up the same way they did in 1956, when I first actually recognized them in the sky. Juice Box is the report of a workshop that I attended which gave a physical demonstration of gravity on other planets by weighting with plaster or sand ordinary household items, including an empty box for juice, so that when you pick it up, it feels the way it would if you were on another planet with its own gravity. VenJupe12 is a geocentric calculation for a Venus-Jupiter conjunction in 2012. The calculation worked so well because Jupiter and Venus have very nearly circular orbits with uniform or steady speeds in them. Try that for yourself, please. The last one, Sin-Sid, explains the whole miasma of sidereal and synodic movements of the planets and how you, for knowing one, you can calculate the other. Okay, we move on to slide 2. All right, this is the quiz question from last time, the lesson on Saturn. I asked for the dates, or at least the year and month, of the edge-on phase of Saturn during the time of Galileo through Huygens, who finally figured out that Saturn was a globe surrounded by a concentric ring. And some of you got bamboozled, because when you played with your planetarium programs, you ended up with several dates in bunches, roughly 15 years apart, and you thought maybe you were mishandling the program or there was some sort of software glitch. Actually, no. If you look at this table, which I cut for you, it shows all the ring crossings, as the edge-on phase is often called, in the 1600s. Just take the first two columns, the date, universal time, and the second column, which is the polarity of motion of the rings, that is, the north to south or south to north. The third column for sun and the visibility, we'll skip that. There actually were, in several edge-on phases, multiple crossings of the ring, or multiple tilts of the ring edge-on. It's tough to explain this verbally as giving the answer to the quiz, but the geometry of the Earth, Sun, and Saturn can cause, during an edge-on phase, a back-and-forth wobble of the rings, or the apparent as we see it, so that we are on the north, south, north, or whatever, and then we stay on one side until the next edge-on phase. So if you got dates, one of these, then for each of the phase edge-on occurrences, you did very, very well. There's not something wrong with your program, or you're not mismanipulating it. There actually were several crossings in certain of the edge-on instances. Okay, slide 3. The same picture we used for the Saturn lesson, but now we look at Jupiter, the largest of the planets. It's not just largest in size. If you took the mass of all of the other planets, and most of them are shown to scale size below, and Saturn on the right, if you took all the mass of those planets, plus all the meteors, all the asteroids, all the comets, and everything else that's associated with the solar system, they would not equal Jupiter. That is, Jupiter contains most of the mass of the solar system outside the Sun. That is roughly 1,000 the mass of the Sun, so that to a good approximation, the solar system dynamics is predominantly the Sun-Jupiter system. And we see in the lower left Earth in comparison, and the lower right Pluto in comparison. Slide 4. a table of facts and figures for the outer planets, including Jupiter, and there's Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. I will not have a separate session for Uranus and Neptune, even though they are in our night sky in summer, fall, 2021. I'll point them out when we do next session, which would be stars of our autumn sky. But it's nice to have that, and if you want, you can just take a snapshot of that slide and then keep it handy to rattle off some facts and figures if you show the planets to other people. Slide numero 5. The Jupiter's orbit is about 5 times the diameter of Earth's, and you see Saturn's orbit about 10 times larger. In the Saturn session, I gave some dialogue about the heliocentric model, how some people complained that it left so much empty space in the universe, whereas the geocentric had the planets nicely nested together. But no, most of the solar system is empty. And a traveler, not knowing about our planets, passing by the sun, might simply overlook them, even the biggest of them all, Jupiter. But that's the relation of the Earth to the Jupiter and Saturn orbits. Number 6, please. Jupiter and Saturn are in our night sky now, September 2001, and they'll stay there to the end of the year. Saturn will move into evening twilight and be lost by the end of the year, and Jupiter will hang in sight through January. They're in the southeast now, or south, depending on the hour, and as the months roll on to the end of the year, they'll be more to the south at nightfall, and then into the southwest. The inset showing the solar system, I have lines of sight from Earth, that's E, to J for Jupiter or S for Saturn, and the angle between those two lines of sight is the angular separation between the two planets on the sky. And in the Saturn session, I showed, especially for those who are just new to this, that the angle closed up in December 2020 for the Great Conjunction. The next time that happens is in 2040. So now until 2030, Jupiter will pull ahead of Saturn, increasing its lead, so that next year, I will probably do Jupiter and Saturn, not in sequence. There may be another lesson of some sort in between, because they'll be dispersed far enough apart. So while Saturn is in view, Jupiter is still not ready to look at. And then by the time Jupiter comes around, there was a slot for an extra session. But by 2030, Jupiter and Saturn will spread out so far they are on opposite sides of the ecliptic, 6 signs apart, 180 degrees. Jupiter still moving faster than Saturn, will then start to chase up to Saturn, closing the gap, approaching Saturn from the west for the conjunction in 2040. But there they are now, evening, nightfall, late night sky. Jupiter is the eastern planet, much the brighter, closer to Fomalhaut, if you know your constellations, and Saturn is near the head of Capricornus, and rather the dimmer of the two. We move on to slide 7. Okay, timetable of activity for Jupiter and also Saturn. It's the same set of events. We have Western Quadrature, which is when Jupiter rises at midnight, which it did a long time ago, and therefore is in your sky during the prime viewing hours. You may have to wait till late night when it just passes the quadrature, but from then on it migrates into earlier and earlier hours in the night. West Station is the beginning of Jupiter's retrograde loop. It's not a real loop. First of all, it's a short one, only a couple of degrees wide, so it kind of stays still in the sky to the casual sight. And because the orbit of Jupiter is almost edge on to the Earth's orbit, instead of going loopy like, say, Mars, it just kind of sways back and forth a bit. But it stops moving direct motion at the Western Station and begins the retrograde motion. There we have opposition, which took place about a week or so ago on August 19th and 20th. That's when it was in the middle of the loop and near the closest approach to the Earth. You see the column next to the event is the distance of the planet in Earth-Sun distance, or in terms of the Earth orbit radius, and the last column gives the angular diameter, which, although it does change, it always is a comfortably large disk to easily see structure on it. Alright, the next thing to come along is the Eastern Station, when the retrograde loop is over and Jupiter resumes direct movement, and Eastern Quadrature is when Jupiter sets at midnight and therefore is out of the morning sky, and thereafter it stays in the pre-midnight sky until it goes into solar conjunction early next year. Okay, in slide 8. Very early drawings, early 1600s, of what the planets looked like in their crude telescopes of the time. We didn't know what's going on with Saturn. That's why you got that funny drawing of it in the upper left. But Jupiter was a globe, Mars is a globe, Venus was a globe also, but the drawing here emphasizes the phases and wide range of angular size. You may want to review the lesson on Venus from early August. Okay, the next slide, slide 9, shows that Jupiter had an extra feature not known to the other planets, at least early 1600s. Galileo found a few stars, tiny stars, stellae, near Jupiter, and didn't think much of them because he already saw a lot of stars dimmer than naked eye limit. He found a couple of dozen inside the Pleiades, and he resolved the beehives into stars. So he figured he'd use them to track the movement of Jupiter. But after a few days or a week or so, he realized that these stars stayed with Jupiter as attendants or a court or a retinue. So speaking Italian, speaking Latin, the word for a aide or attendant is Sakalus. More than one of them were satellites. If you see this word spelled out and you pronounce it like an English word, you say satellites. So satellites, well, they do attend the central planet. See, but the origin of the void itself comes from the anthropomorphic concept that the king of the planets would have aides or ministers or a court to accompany him. Among the uses of the satellites of Jupiter, Galileo used this to show that all motion did not have to center on the Earth, because obviously Jupiter had these satellites which went around him, not the Earth. It also debunked the idea that the Earth could not move because the Moon could not keep up with it. It'd be left behind. Jupiter certainly moves, yet the satellites stay with it. This was not, of course, proof that the Earth went around the Sun, but it demolished one of the arguments that it couldn't go around the Sun and it had to be the center of the cosmos. Well, Galileo numbered the satellites, and after others had verified their existence and worked out their periods and so on, the order was arranged for 1, 2, 3, 4 from the innermost and fastest to the outermost and slowest. And those are the way we number them today. Newer satellites were simply numbered in order of discovery. Amalthea, which was discovered in the 1890s, satellite number 5, happens to be closer to Jupiter than Io. But since the Galilean moons were numbered and had been used for 2 centuries, they left them alone, and from then on, wherever the hell any other new moon was, it's just numbered in order of discovery. We'll have a quiz about this number versus name. It's not part of one of the slides directly, but you will have to dig into your astronomy history to get the answer to the question. Wait until after the lesson, I'll go over it with you. Okay, slide 10. I'm not sure what the buzz is, but it's low enough, so I'm not going to bother with it. We have a modern view of the moons of Jupiter. Leave the structure on the disk alone for the time being, but we have the moons. They're kind of strung out along the axis, the equatorial axis of the planet, because by happenstance, the equatorial plane of the planet, which is also the orbital plane of those 4 large moons, is also edge on. So the moons kind of go back and forth, back and forth. Contrast that motion with the moons of Saturn from our Saturn lesson. Here the moons are named, the ones that you all know, especially you millennials and submillennials. Io is the closest to the planet, then Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. Of course, here they can be in any order depending on where they are within their orbits. But Callisto is the one that usually goes pretty far away, about 10 diameters of Jupiter, whereas Io whips around, staying only a couple of diameters away. But here we have the names of the satellites. And there will be a quiz afterwards about the names and numbers. So stick around after the last slide. Okay, we move on to slide 11. All right, here we have a graphical illustration comparing the Jupiter moons with planets and other moons in the solar system. You notice that Ganymede is the largest moon in the solar system, followed pretty closely by Titan, which belongs to Saturn. Us older folk grew up with knowing Titan as the largest moon, but this was all in the pre-space age era, when moon diameters were kind of guess and golly by observations from the Earth. And we have the other moons there. We see Pluto, Earth's moon, Mercury, and so on. All right, slide 13. All right, the author here sketched out the locations of the moons for a six-day period in 2018, and he labeled them with the initials of their names. You can see how they flip back and forth, so that anytime you look at Jupiter, the moons will be pretty much in a totally unique alignment. So if you draw a sketch or take a picture of Jupiter with its moons, that picture will never be duplicated for the rest of your life, and probably for 1,000 years to come, because the periods are not exactly even multiples of each other, and the little discrepancies prevent an exact duplication. So when you look at Jupiter, you're seeing a scene which probably no one in previous history ever saw. Slide 14. And this is the current way for you to keep track of the moons, and it's included in the observing section of magazines for astronomy and websites for observing the planets. It covers a whole month, of which I took a 10-day slice. The middle band, vertical band, center line, the width is the diameter of Jupiter's disk. The spiral paths are the tracks of the satellites as they go round and around the planet. And like with the previous one, which were like snapshots, this is more like a movie, if you can imagine film trolled through the camera on a clockwork, and the satellites scribe their paths over many days. And the satellites here are named at appropriate places, and the paths are color-coded anyway. The days are within alternate colored horizontal bands. The top of the band for a given day is 0 hours UT on that day, and the bottom edge of the band is 2359 of that day. You have to convert your local or clock time to universal time before you can use this chart. So having done that, you simply could estimate in between the border of the day's band and where that line intersects the satellite track is the location of the satellite relative to Jupiter. And then the width of that center band being a diameter, you can sort of pace out how many diameters of Jupiter the satellite is. East is on the left side of the diagram, and to the right is west. And if you're not sure in your telescope which is east and west, turn off the clock drive and the planet will drift away because of the diurnal Earth rotation. So the drift direction is west. Now you can recenter Jupiter and put the clock drive back on again. So you can see Io tightly wraps around Jupiter while Callisto takes the lazy route toward the edge of the picture. Slide 15 shows that the moons can interact with the globe of Jupiter. Because the moon's orbits are edge onto us, the moons can come in front of Jupiter as transits or be covered by Jupiter in occultation. So we see, simulated of course, examples of that where you have near the top a transit of the moon across Jupiter, and then at the bottom we have an example of an occultation. Now, when the moon is in front of the planet, a small telescope will lose sight of it because the moon will be camouflaged within the texture on the disk. So the best you can do really is watch the moon come onto the disk, wait the appropriate time later, and see the moon come off it. For occultations, of course, the moon is hidden, so you see the moon go behind the disk, and after it's spent its time there, you see it pop out. Slide 16 gives two other interactions of the satellites with the disk. Jupiter and the moons are opaque, and therefore they cast shadows. So in the lower left, we have the shadow of Jupiter behind him. Of course, you don't see that shadow, not any more than you see the Earth's shadow near full moon. You have to wait until the moon goes into the shadow for a lunar eclipse. And we'll have one in November over all of the United States and much of the rest of the world. We'll talk about that next time when we do our autumn sky. So we see there a moon entering the shadow, disappears, then it reappears at egress. So you have the clear sight at the appropriate moment of seeing a moon to one side of Jupiter, then suddenly, poof, it disappeared because it went into the shadow of the planet. And then you have to wait a while, and then, poof, it reappears and continues its march through his orbit. A corollary event is when the shadow of the moon falls onto Jupiter, and the good folk living up there experience a solar eclipse. The shadow for us with ordinary telescopes is a black dot, a speck almost, trudging along the disk. And we see there not only the track of the satellite shadow, but a snapshot showing the disk of the shadow disk on the planet. Now these events are predictable, and you could anticipate when they occur if we look at slide 17. There are many ways to show predicted events involving Jupiter and the moons. This particular one uses a three-character code. The first character is the number of the moon, 1 through 4. The second is a letter for the event. And the third codes what the event begins or ends. And the letterpress at the top explains what symbols do what. The dates and hours are in universal time. Again, you have to shift your clock or local's longitude time to UT. And then you can anticipate the events and, you know, watch out for them. After a few decades of watching Jupiter's moons in the 1600s, by about 1700, we were pretty confident that we had now a means to tell longitude. You remember, in the 1600s, especially with the ever-increasing commerce across the Atlantic to America and the explorations into the Latin America, by the South Atlantic, and all over the Pacific Ocean, we had no good way to tell the longitude of our ships. Latitude was easy by sighting on the Sun or the North Star. However, there are so many of these events. Just in a couple of days in this snippet of a table, we have probably a dozen events involving the moons of Jupiter. So these can be calculated for the ship's home port. And if you were a British nautical almanac office that did these tables, the home port is London or Greenwich. And that's what we use universally today anyway. So the navigator was given a table, probably for the whole year, because you know, sea voyages took many, many months. The ship also carried a clock, a pretty crummy one really, but every day it was set to the local longitude time by the calculated hour of sunset or the noon position of the sun, and the clock would run good enough for the rest of the night. So the ship would observe an event, and you look up in his almanac the universal home port time. The difference between home port minus observe in substance was his longitude in hours and minutes as a fraction of the full 24-hour rotation of the Earth. There were lots of practical problems with this, and those of us who took eclipse trips, the newer folk naively brought their telescope out on deck at night when the ship was underway, figuring they can do stargazing under a beautiful dark sky in the middle of the ocean, and then got totally frustrated as the deck rumbled and rattled and rocked with the waves, and they couldn't do any good stargazing with the telescope. Well, that is what happened in the 1700s. It wasn't until the mid-1700s when a clock was mechanically securely built, so once it was set at the home port, it would stay accurate throughout the whole voyage. And you could make observations using it, not so much for the Jupiter events, but for the position of the moon in the sky or timings of lunar eclipses. But for us, it sometimes is an exercise to make believe we're landed on an island somewheres, and we observe in our local time, not zone time, but longitude time, the event, and look up what the universal time is, and then compute the longitude of our observing site, and then compare that with the World Atlas or Gazetteer, which posts the longitude for where we are, or how we use the GPS receiver, and see how close we get. It's a good exercise to show what our heritage is in astronomy. See, but anyway, that's the phenomena of the moons, as it's often called, and this author used numbers rather than the initials of the names. Okay, we now look at the disk itself. If you have a telescope, say 100 millimeters and anything larger, you can notice that the planet has texture or structure. And we see this in slide 18. Probably the first thing you notice, especially if you have normal eyesight with no astigmatism, is that Jupiter is not spherical, but it's flattened a bit. It's an oblate spheroid. If you turn your head one way or the other, looking in the eyepiece, it shows up better. Some people think that it's the effect of the stripes on the, like wearing a sweater with horizontal stripes, subjectively make you look fatter than if you wore vertical stripes. But no, the planet actually is flattened because it's a fluid. We're not looking at a solid surface or even a thin atmosphere. We're looking at a planet which is substantially all gas. There may be a kernel of a liquid or a solid in the center, but you got tens of thousands of kilometers of atmosphere. And so as the planet rotates, which it does pretty damn fast, about 10-hour rotation period, the equator bulges out as the fluid comes to an equilibrium surface. That's the first thing. The next is the bands that run parallel to the bulge axis, if you will, which is actually the equator of the planet. Recall again that the planet's equator and the orbits of the moons is edge on to us, so the bands are virtually straight across the planet. If you're patient and you see a little structure like a loop or a dot or a wrinkle in the belt, and you wait about an hour, you will see noticeably that the planet rotated. A 10-hour rotation means that within one Earth day, Jupiter makes 2.5 of its days. So you have a rapidly rotating with the beautiful colored bands, which are earth colored, you know, browns and reds and orange and pinks and yellows, sort of like the swirls that we would see in some kinds of cakes, especially a square cake where the different flavors are banded within it, and you get bleeding from one to the next, and you get these irregular stripes. That's what you have on Jupiter. And the structure within the bands is caused by the rapid rotation, which tears and shreds these belts, as we call them. B, Bravo, E, L, T, Tango, ESA. They're also called bands, but belt is the more prevalent one. And we notice that you can see texture within the belt. They're not just vague stripes. A smaller scope, less than 100 millimeter, and you have practiced eyes, you'll see the darker or denser of the belts as definite streaks. But you need about 100 millimeter to start noticing, no, it's not just a streak, but there's a little wrinkle over there, it's a little darker over there. And over the evening of observing, which has to be at least an hour, hey, the planet turned. Occasionally, we'll see spots, light or dark, within the belt. They're temporary, they come and go, and sometimes they don't even last one rotation of the planet, and the Shangri-La of objects on the disk is the gray red spot. It was first seen in the 1620s, but it's not a permanent feature. Some years it's very thin and weak and is camouflaged against the disc and not noticed, and in other years it's dark as if someone had shot a paintball at the planet, and a 60mm, 75mm telescope shows it up. In fact, I can see the red spot, not the belts. Now years in the 2020s, so far, the red spot is thin, pale, and curiously shrunken. It's classical or traditional size, it's about 3 diameters of Earth. So about 35, 36,000 kilometers in diameter or linear width, the longitudinal length. Now it's down to about 25,000 kilometers, and no one knows why. We have the Juno space probe in orbit around the planet now, and as it loops close to the planet, it is imaging the red spot. So if you go to one of the NASA or other space enthusiast websites, you can see what's going on with the red spot, you know, close up. But the red spot partakes in the rotation of the planet, so when you look at the planet at an arbitrary moment, the red spot may be on the limb, seeing the edge on and not noticed, or on the far side of the planet. Slide 19. This would be on your final exam, so study it well. Bah! I was just kidding you! You don't have to remember all this crap. Now snap that picture and keep it in your observing material for Jupiter. The lighter parts of the planet are called zones, and they're named after the latitude climate they sit in, the equatorial, tropical, temperate. And the belts also are named for the latitude climate they sit in. A climate is an interesting word. It comes from the Greek klima, which we would treat as a latitude zone on the Earth, but also connoted the kind of weather from torrid near the equator, you know, in middle of Africa, to the temperate zone, which were the Mediterranean regions, to the frigid klima, which was up northern Europe and going into the Scandinavia. So klima represented a weather pattern, and more of them, or let's say the combined form of the word, was klimata, plural, or klimato, for using it in combination as a prefix. And that's how we get our word climate, English pronunciation, for a normal or long-term weather regime in a certain location. So the climata of Jupiter give the names to the belts north and south. The Great Red Spot lives in the south temperate zone, and stays there more or less. So as the planet rotates and the longitude meridians of the planet go round and round, eventually the red spot will come along. The vertical line in the diagram is the longitude on Jupiter, which is face on to the Earth, or a person floating in the clouds along that line would see the Earth at the highest point, the culmination, in the south, if you will, of the planet's own sky. Hence, it would be nice if when we look at Jupiter, we know what longitude is facing us. Now, if Jupiter were a solid, say like Mars, even though Mars has an atmosphere, it's transparent, and we base the longitude system, the geographic grid, on the features on the solid surface. We can't do that with Jupiter because we're looking at the tops of clouds. The best we can do, and it's a fluid like the sun, so it rotates fastest near the equator and slowest near the poles. So in the next slide, 20, we show how we get around this. We set up a schematic system of longitudes, recognizing that the equator moves faster, has a shorter day than the poles. So the planet between the north and south equatorial belts rotates at a rate which we call system one, and a longitude of the central meridian is calculated and paced for it. The rest of the planet from the north torrid zone and north and the south torrid zone toward the south pole has a slower rate averaged out over the slower and longer day for system two. And a solar system program where you can fly to or orbit a planet will give you the system one and system two, which is arrowed about two-thirds down the page. The text in the upper right was a blank area where I wrote some notes about system one and system two. And for the day that the program was set for, we read out system one longitude and the system two longitude. System three is not a visible feature on the planet, but if you happen to be a home radio enthusiast and you listen to shortwave, you know that Jupiter emits strong pulse and bursts of radio hash, like static. And they come from a something or other, a hot spot inside the planet, below the visible clouds, and it has its own rotation period, and home enthusiasts in their literature, radio enthusiasts in their literature, will see system three longitude, which is the rotation of this hotspot, so they know when to turn on the radios and listen when that hotspot is on the front side of the disk. But for us visual observers, photographers, imagers, system one and two is what we need. Okay, what about the red spot? It has a longitude in the south temperate zone, which would be system two. But the red spot floats in the cloud deck relative to the south temperate zone or belt. Slide 21 illustrates that for year 2000. Across the top is the system 2 longitude on Jupiter, and you have months running down the left. The stuff on the right-hand side will skip. The left-hand squiggle line is the longitude of the red spot, and sometimes it lags and sometimes it leads the position of a spot in system two. So the red spot does its own little thing. It's the cat on Jupiter, if you will. So we can't simply use system 2 longitude to figure out when the red spot is visible. How then do we do this? Slide 21. Jupiter websites and monthly astronomy magazines in the observance section will post recent observations of the Great Red Spot. This is done by dedicated observers who watch the planet, and they note when the red spot is centered on the planet, that is, sits on the central meridian. And for that moment, they either calculate or look up with a good solar system program what is the central meridian in System 2, and then they report that to the publication or website, who then posts it in its pages. So you have to go to one of them to get a recent, no more than a month or two old, longitude of the red spot. Then in your solar system program, there usually is, but not always, usually is a input for planetary data, and where the arrowed entry is about 2/3, 3/4 down the left hand side, it's asking you as an input the current longitude of the red spot, which you punch in, and then as you manipulate the program for you set up your observing run for the night, the planet will then show, besides the stylized belts and zones, a stylized red spot in the proper place on the disk for the hour that you're setting the program. I do mind that you really have to go through this exercise at least, or no more than, every month or every other month, because if you went back to slide 20, you saw that the time scale of the wandering is about 1 month. That's how you have to know when to anticipate the red spots. You pick a very recent observed location and trace it. Slide 22. The author for this picture selected one from each year that he was photographing the planet, montaged them to make one Jupiter year, 12 Earth years, from 1999 through 2010. The planet shows secular changes in the density and darkness of its belts and also of the Great Red Spot. Most of the pictures have the red spot on the front face, and some, I think all of them do. The spot is kind of thin and weak, and you may miss it, as you would in that particular year with a telescope. Where's the red spot? It's gone. And you have all this banter and chatter at your club meeting. Oh, did the red spot disappear? Did it sink? Did it change color? Did it go woke? I don't know. But it'll come back when it wants to. And that's the charm of Jupiter. On the whole, Jupiter, among all the planets that we see, is the most kinetic and dynamic. On the disk itself, and earlier in the lesson with the moons. So you will never be disappointed. Mars will spook you by a dust storm, a real thinning out of the maria. Venus doesn't look like anything. Any markers on it are pretty vague and uncertain. Well, it does have the phases. And Saturn kind of looks the same every time you look at it. I mean, it's drop-dead gorgeous, and I think I used to know a lady friend who was interested in science, not an astronomer, who bought a hat. The crown was the upper hemisphere of the planet, and the brim was the rings. Oh, she always got a seat on the train. Slide 23, running to the end. It is a shorter lesson, but I covered really everything we need to know for going out and seeing the planet. But the last two will kind of freak you out. 23 shows something bizarre. Whenever we speak of Jupiter and the moons, it's the four inner, bright, big Galileo moons. But my solar system simulator, which was written many decades ago, in fact, it was written when Windows was still a brand new novelty, had embedded in it the 16 pre-space age moons. Now, in the center, where the leader is pointing to, is a dot, which is Jupiter, and the line running through it is the path of the Galileo moons. Remember, they just go back and forth across the disk, and the length of that line is the diameter of the farthest satellite, Callisto. The other 12 moons run all over the place, but they're not in nice round orbits. They're meandering around all over the place like moss around the lamp. That's the chaotic moons. Saturn has them also. And the Earth may have temporary ones, actually co-orbiting asteroids, which is a whole other story. But here, the reason they're wandering around like that is they're so far away from Jupiter that they're pulled by the sun's gravity, and so instantaneously they are in a new orbit. They cannot be calculated by ordinary astrodynamical formulae. The way you find out where they are is you start with a observed known position and then use a simulator, which this program is doing, to calculate them on the fly by invoking the Newton gravity law interval by interval, say at daily intervals, and where the next interval will shove the planet is a guess. It is not determinate. That's why you get this meandering pattern. It shows that astronomy is not all facts and figures and formulae and equations, but very often it has to be done by brute force application of Newton's gravity law interval by interval. And the last slide may blow your mind. You have it all taped in place, masking tape, duct tape. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, we'll go to slide 24. If we could see the orbits of all the moons, or at least the bunch that were in this solar system simulator, as if the moon's orbit were luminous, this picture shows how big the Jovian moon system is compared to the stars in the sky. I chose a date when Jupiter was near the Pleiades and Hyades, and the entire Jovian system would swallow the Pleiades, and it would be a tight fit inside the Hyades. Now, this of course could never be realized visually because the orbit is just a mathematical line. It can't be made luminous by any means in nature. So what you would see are four bright dots, those are the Galilean ones, and a sprinkling of dim dots, which would be for all the other moons. And unless you stayed there and watched them for a while, you might think they were field stars. So that concludes our lesson for Jupiter. And we now ask for the quiz, which is astronomy history. Dig out old textbooks or old magazines, typically before 1970. That is, before we started sending space probes to Jupiter. The satellites in those references, in those publications, were referred to by their numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and the newer ones, 5, 6, and all the way out. Then suddenly, about 1970, mid-70s, these magazines and astronomy references started using names, which are almost exclusively what we use today. So the question is, where did these names come from, and why were they suddenly put into use more than 300 years after the moons were even discovered? Until then, next time, late September, pray for clear skies.